Hello everyone, I'm Asha Nayaswami. We're continuing our study of Swamiji's Book of Letters in Divine Friendship. Let's begin with a prayer. Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, Friend, Beloved God, Jesus Christ, Babaji Krishna, Lahiri Mahashaya, Swami Sri Yukteswar, Beloved Master Paramhansa Yogananda, Saints of all religions, dear Divine Friend Swami Kriyananda, humbly we bow at thy feet. Be with us. Make your presence known. Let us feel your whisper in the heart, hear your whisper in our minds. Feel your spirit with us, lifting us beyond the mundane cares of this everyday life into the realm of thy joy, that everything we do becomes permeated with thy light. Om, peace. Amen. Keshav is going to start us with chanting. Last week we talked at great length about I have made thee pole star of my life. So he'll chant that at the beginning tonight.
Star of my life, I have made thee pole star of my life. Though my sea is dark and my stars are gone, though my sea is dark and my stars are gone, still I see the path through thy mercy. Still I see the path through thy mercy. I have made thee pole star of my life. I have made thee pole star of my life. Though my sea is dark and my stars are gone, my sea is dark and my stars are gone, still I see the path through thy mercy. Still I see the path through thy mercy. I have made thee pole star of my life. I have dark and my stars are gone. Though my sea is dark and my stars are gone, still I see the path through thy mercy. Still I see the path through thy mercy. I have made thee star of my life. I have made thee pole star of my life. Though my sea is dark and my stars are gone, though my sea is dark and my stars are gone, still I see the path through thy still I see the path through thy mercy. I have made thee pole star of my life. I have made thee pole star of my life. Though my sea is dark and my stars are gone, though my sea is dark and my stars are gone, still I see the path through thy mercy. 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 I have made thee the star of my life. I have made star of my life.
Meditate now for a few minutes. Om peace. Amen. I forgot my glasses over on the other table. Thank you. Well, we are on the last letter, and I'm not reading every single letter. Well, actually, there's one here that I haven't. Let me make sense to you. We're on the last two letters in the section called Love, which is the first section of this book. And this letter is simply a little amusing. It's going to be my excuse to just tell you a joke. September 11th, as it happens, 1990, Swami writes, astral samadhi is not going into and roaming about in the astral world, but merging into the infinite energy of which the astral worlds are projections. The astral world is the world of energy. The causal world is the world of thought. It is a form of samadhi. Causal samadhi, by contrast, is oneness with the Christ consciousness. And then Swami says, don't get all tangled up in definitions, however. Love God. That's what it's all about. The other day, Keshava and Tandava, two of the lovely men who live here, were doing a sound check. You know, you have to just ask whatever. So Keshava says to Tandava, tell me the difference between Sabhakalpa and Nirbhakalpa Samadhi. Tandava looks very thoughtful for a moment. He says, one begins with an N and the other begins with an S. Keshava says, I can feel you're speaking from your own experience. Tandava says, absolutely, I only speak from my own experience. It's sort of a long-standing joke in the community that trying to define the difference between Nabhakalpa and Sabhakalpa Samadhi, I can't even say it out loud, how impossible it is. Many years ago, a novice minister set out to give a service, and he started trying to describe those two states. With all due respect, he was not talking from experience. He was just talking. And that was, later on I learned something which is called the first law of holes, H-O-L-E-S. When you find yourself in one, you stop digging. And he learned, I mean, we all learned, these things become great jokes for all of us. But you have to be careful not to think that being able to define things that are so beyond our experience, well, my experience, actually really gives you anything spiritually. That's why Tandava is, I'm just going to stick with what I know. I know how to spell both words, and that's how I can tell the difference between them. Then you're safe. You're always safe. Whenever I've been asked, you know, to advise or give suggestions to people who are just starting out in the role of having to share these teachings, the first thing I say, which is very important, it's hard for us to appreciate, especially those of us who live deeply within Ananda, where we are surrounded by saints and highly advanced souls. It's hard to realize how much even the least of us knows. If you know why, in this big world, out of all the choices we have, that one decides to seek God and knows that seeking God is what I really want to do, compared to the majority of people who either have no inkling or haven't yet been able to make that commitment in themselves, there's a vast sea of understanding and knowledge that in the context of having come into an ashram where everyone feels that way, one doesn't realize how important all that knowledge is. So I say to anyone, if you've committed yourself to the spiritual path, you're already deeply wise. And just to say that is enough, not merely that I've done it, but why. And the other half is always stay within what you know. Because within what you know is enough. You don't have to say more than that. One of the times when Swami went to Los Angeles to give programs there, this was in the early 70s, very early 70s. And whenever he would go to LA for public work, which he would do periodically, he would usually take a little troop of us along with him, and we would go to the bookstores and sell his books, and sometimes we'd try to get him publicity. We were all very inexperienced, and we just kind of rush around and do what we could to support him. And one of the trips that he was there, a man named Haridas, Haridas with his wife Roma, is now the leader of our Ananda Center in Bangalore, India. He's an American. Both of them are Americans, he and his wife, but they've lived there for many years now. And Haridas was, I don't know if he was 20 at that time. He came to Ananda, I believe, when he was 18. And he was very enthusiastic, and he went to some local television station in Los Angeles to persuade them to have Swami Kriyananda as a guest. Haridas is a marvelous human being, very humble and very charming in his humility. So what happened was the station manager was completely infatuated with Haridas and wasn't particularly interested in this Kriyananda fellow that he'd never met. He wanted to put Haridas on the television show. And Swami, you know, when Haridas called and basically said, "Sir, I was trying for one thing and something else has happened. What should I do?" Because he wanted to take advantage of the opportunity, but he was the last person in the world to put himself forward. He just really didn't know what to do, so he called Swami to ask. And Swami he said later, he had to admit Haridas was 20, and he wasn't a particularly ripe old 20. He was just a good, solid 20 years old. But Swami knew that he had spiritual greatness in him, which he does. And Swami said, "Sure, just go on the air." And then we all watched the program, or Swamiji and a group watched the program. Actually, I don't think I was there. And just sort of wondering what was going to happen. But what happened, and the rest of it, the whatever the talk was, it all went beautifully. But at a certain point, Haridas was wearing one of these astrological bangles. This is copper, silver, and gold, obviously, self-evidently gold, in a particular proportion, total weight, proportional weight of all the metals. It's a general formula that is beneficial for everyone. Other kinds of bangles or astrological stones, which is what these rings are specific to each person's horoscope. Of course, many people wear the same stones because certain planets need strengthening or balancing. But this particular formula, everyone can wear. Sri Yukteswar passed it to Master, so it goes back. It's an ancient formula. So none of us had any money at that time, but there was this woman who was very well-to-do, and she bought like 40 of these bangles, or maybe it was more like 25, and passed them out to all the renunciates, and the most dedicated people in Ananda couldn't afford one. Cost a crashing $150 at that point, which was not very much money. It's based on the price of gold. Now it costs $1,200, $2,000. It's like 1.5 times the price of gold, 1 ounce of gold, or 2.5 times. I don't remember. It's thousands. But anyway, so we all had them, impoverished as we were. And so Haridas is sitting there, and I think he had it around his wrist. And it was an unusual thing for a man to wear, especially then. So the man says, "You know, what is that?" Now the explanation is that the reason that pure metals are valuable is because they inherently vibrate with energy. And the same with gemstones. They have magnetism. They have energy. And so they strengthen your aura, and your aura is your own magnetism, and then it gives you more self-determining power. I mean, that's a way to think about it. And this one is beneficial to your astrological horoscope, to all horoscopes, because it strengthens your aura. These stones help strengthen the aura in the particular vibrations related to Mercury and Jupiter, emerald and yellow sapphire. I've just given you 100% of what I know about astrology. But anyway, that is what I do know. So it's not easy to explain what, especially in the early 70s, what is an aura? What is an astrological? What is your horoscope? Why is this general? What is a specific horoscope? What do you mean metals emit, you know, special vibrations, and that's why they've always had value, and that's why kings had gold and kings has jewels? I mean, you can see it's a big thing. So when the interviewer asked that, Swami sort of gulped a little. But Haridas was perfect. Haridas stayed right within what he knew. He didn't try to explain the difference between Nirvikalpa and Sambhakalpa Samadhi, although I'm sure he could have spelled it. He could have answered like Tandava. He looked at it and he said, "I'm not entirely sure what it does," he said. "My guru recommended that I wear it. And he said, and every time I see it, It reminds me of what I've dedicated my life to doing. How could you be more perfect than that? It's not how we can define things and how we can talk about them. It's that we love God and we feel it in the heart. So you can see in this letter, Swami answers the question. This is what astral samadhi is. This is what causal samadhi is. Don't worry about what astral and causal samadhi are. Love God. Because if you love God, everything else will follow. So now, the last letter in this section, which was written in the late 1980s. I was interested in your dream. Of course, we don't know what it is, but by everything else he says, the presumption is that it was a dream that involved Master. Yes, deepen your attunement with Master. It will help you to develop deeper faith in him. Surrender every little worry to him. He is pleased when we offer him everything. Ask always, is this what you would have me do? Feel him working through you, meditating through you, speaking to others through you. Serve him in everything you do. Ask him to guide you in all things, to discipline you if needed, and always to help you feel his love for you. Don't identify with your failings. Your aspiration is to reach the infinite. And your sincere devotion will surely lead you there. Such a sweet and reassuring letter. And he's also just sort of telling us, he says, try to be more in tune with Master. Yes, it will deepen your faith to be more in tune. So we have sort of two points that we're talking about. Attunement is a word that is very, very common in spiritual life, especially I don't know actually if it's used as commonly in other ashrams as it is used in ours, but the word attunement comes forth very frequently when we're talking about Master's path. Again, it might even just be Ananda, but it could be other SR, other Yogananda lines. I don't know. Swami himself has written in several different places about how Swamiji said when Master would speak in public, he'd talk about many different aspects of the path and he would teach many different things. He said when Master would speak in private to the monks or to the disciples, all he would talk about, or mostly what he would talk about, was attunement, being in tune with the Guru. And it's quoted in some place where Master said, you know, so-and-so has left the path, people leave the path. It needn't happen if you stay in tune. He even spoke of a particular woman disciple who was second, who he declared was second to Gyanamata in realization. And Swamiji said he knew for a fact that she never meditated for more than 30 minutes at a time. In other words, she didn't follow the pattern that you would imagine of long hours in meditation. Master said she attained what she attained by attunement. So it's a word that is really worth understanding. And I can spell it. It begins with an A that has two T's in it. In fact, it has three of them. But I try to understand it. And it's within my portfolio to try to understand it, because it's the avenue that will lead to everything else. So over the course of many years, I've gone in and out of different ways of understanding it. This is the one I've been thinking of most recently. Thinking of the reality of the fact that this world is vibration, and one of the confusing, where our senses deceive us compared to what we know as deeper reality. The entire universe, so they say, is nothing but energy. And it's all one substance. Certainly when I look at it, it doesn't look like one substance. It looks like many, many, many different substances. There's my body, there's the clothes I'm wearing, there's the book, there's my glasses, there's the chair, there's this beautiful cup, which was a gift from friends in Mumbai, and I promised them I would use it during my webinars. There's the hot water that's inside of it. All of these things seem completely separate. I know that Master says, and Einstein says, and everyone says, that it's an illusion. But it doesn't look or feel like one, and even more weirdly, if it's all the same stuff, why doesn't it just smush back together? Well, one of the just interesting explanations that at least works when I think about it is because it's energy in a state of vibration. And if you think of the voice is one of the easiest ways, I think, to understand vibrations that match and don't match. I'm a mediocre singer, but I have a better ear than I have a voice, which is one of the reasons I don't sing that much, is because I can hear what I'm not doing. But in any case, when you are pitch to pitch with someone, there's just this merging that you can feel. You can just feel how the energy just goes together and all the voices become one voice. When one person is singing one note, and notes, musical notes are a particular vibration of sound, but this note is a little off and it's not a harmonizing note, then you can just feel it. The two vibrations just can't get together. Even though they try, they just can't get together. Dissonance is very popular in modern music, and people do that all the time on purpose now, where things clash, and look at the world we live in. Swamiji said, music not only reflects consciousness, it also creates it. So the music of our time reflects the consciousness of our time, and it also is unfortunately perpetuating itself with dissonance and conflict and anger and lack of beauty and so on. But as the phrase goes, don't get me started. Not that there's any of you getting me started, so I think I'm just saying to myself, don't get me started. In any case, but when the notes match, how beautiful it is. So our whole consciousness, whatever we're doing and thinking, you know, we are just a pattern of energy. It's the oddest thing. We feel so fixed. Our ideas feel fixed. All of these things feel fixed. But this is the way I loved it. I love to think about it. The only difference between the worst criminal and the greatest saint is the way they behave. It's just like if a criminal has a sudden vision of Jesus or a sudden vision of some great master and suddenly becomes filled with the love of God and from then on is the soul of compassion and kindness and can't do anything but chant the name of God and serve his fellow man, he was a criminal yesterday and he's a saint today. And what happened, the only thing that happened was he attuned himself to a different reality and then began to vibrate with that reality. So we're always vibrating with some reality or the other. On my on the YouTube channel that has all the recordings I've done, there's a 4-part series on the chakras, which has proved to be exceedingly popular. And for good reason, because the information that Swami has given us about the chakras is so clear and so commonsensical. And in the context of that, I talk about sort of how everything that we think or do or say or act falls on a spectrum, you might say, of awareness from matter is the only reality. I am completely separate. I am not part of anything but my own little story here. There is no greater reality. And I live, I die. That's it right here. Let's just say that's on this side. And on this side is the infinite consciousness, Christ consciousness. When speaking of the chakras, I'm talking about the spectrum that the chakras can represent, but it's too complex a subject for right now. But if we think of that as like a piano keyboard, and even when the piano tuner comes in, he knows what each of those keys is supposed to, however you measure it, but has an actual number, which is the actual vibration. And if we think of, if there was a number from complete material consciousness to God realization, and realize that we're not clean, we're not like all sitting at one point and stay there, and then we move up one more octave, and then we move up one more note, and then we move up another half step. It's that we have a whole flow of energy, and at certain times and days and decades of our life, we sort of move up and down, sometimes concentrating on different parts of that, every so often having these extraordinarily elevated moments, perhaps not a full God realization, but much closer to the infinite. And then perhaps for one reason or another, we fall very low. Every time we're vibrating, you see, that's us for the time that we're vibrating. That's who we are. If it's criminal, for that time we're criminal. If it's saintly, for that time we're saintly. But it's just a vibration of energy. Master takes it a giant step further and says that what we manifest does not originate with us. The way he put that is that thoughts are universal, not individual. And as individuals, we do not create our state of consciousness or our thoughts and attitudes and actions. We merely tune in and reflect universal states. And it's all marvelously interesting and extremely worth just meditating on a lot. Because if we can really grasp how mutable, how fluid what we think of as me, the way we use the personal pronoun, and it's a target that never stays still and is completely influenceable by the decisions that we make. What we do today is who we are tomorrow. It's just as simple as that. And now it gets a little more intricate because of the chakras and the way energy is stored in the chakras and reincarnation. But I'm not going to spoil it for you if you haven't seen that course yet. And if you have, you know what I mean. But the basic principle is simple. So what are we vibrating? At what wavelength are we vibrating? What state of consciousness does that reflect? And what it reflects determines what we attract to ourselves and what we can merge with. So if we're very, very materialistic and somebody talks to you about spiritual things, basically you don't even hear them. In fact, in the Bhagavad Gita, there are these marvelous verses about the progress of being able even to learn spiritual teaching. And there's various stages. Now, I'm not going to be quoting this accurately. This is what I remember it meant in what I would call the vernacular, which was, at first, when people talk about spiritual things, you don't even hear their voice. And then they talk about it, and it's absolutely incomprehensible. It just sounds like gibberish. It's like they're talking English, and you have no idea what was spoken. Then you advance to the point where you actually hear the words, but they don't mean anything to you. Then you hear them, and they have meaning, and you understand, but the instant they stop talking, you forget. Now, I hope I'm being fair to Krishna, but that's how I remember it. And then it progresses, where you hear it and you remember it for a short time, and desire drives it out of your mind, step by step, until it really becomes meaningful to you. Now, the reason it becomes meaningful to you is because as we progress spiritually, our vibration begins to shift. Now, we still may have a spectrum, but the whole piano keyboard starts moving in one direction. So that even the bottom of our awareness is higher than it used to be. There's still a north and south pole, but the whole thing is much more elevated than here. I mean, if you're way here, you could be a murderer, you could be a drunk, you could abuse people, you could do terrible things, you could get to the point where that's really unthinkable to you. A friend of mine was just talking to me earlier today about when he was a teenager and he was actually studying martial arts and was kind of a big, you know, guy like this. But then a real bully wanted to fight with him. And it was very interesting to him to realize that he was simply incapable of doing it. Even though he was studying martial arts as a theory, when there was somebody in front of him and he really had the option to punch him, he just couldn't do it. He was incapable of doing it. Swami Kriyananda, when the Second World War came, and he was drafted. I guess he must have been drafted because he had to go to an army examination. As it happened, he had a heart murmur, which I think he was unaware of even at that point. But he had a heart murmur. He also had bad eyesight, but I think it was the heart murmur. And so he was considered unfit for military service. But Swamiji said about it, he was fortunate that he was declared unfit, 4F, because that's what they called it, because I grew up in the Vietnam era, so I knew the issue of the draft was a really big thing. to be declared 4F for those who didn't want to fight was really important. But Swamiji said to be declared physically unfit, he said, was a great relief because, as he put it quite simply, he absolutely could not lift a weapon against another human being. He wasn't sure what he would have done, but there was no question. It was just beyond him to do it. It was a vibration of consciousness he simply couldn't enter. Now, Swamiji's not impractical. He understands that at times, some kind of violent restraint is necessary. But he just said in that context he couldn't do it. So, because the vibration isn't there. So now, let's go on to what I'm talking about with attunement. So, what we have to understand, we somehow imagine that the guru starts talking when we start asking him questions, but that's not true. The masters they're constantly beaming out. The vibration of the masters is always there. The infinite vibration is always there. I think of a master as a perpetually lit lighthouse. The lighthouse doesn't know whether there's any ships that need him. It's just his job to stand there and radiate the light. And so the guru is always there radiating the light, or however you want to think about it. Whether we perceive it is not a question of the guru, it's a question of us. It's when we are able to get on the same wavelength as that light. I was using vibration, so I'll stay there. The guru, in another way of saying it, is always, always chanting Om at a certain frequency, just always chanting at the frequency of their infinite consciousness. That vibration is constantly ringing through creation, just ringing through creation. But if we're not in tune with it, we just don't hear it, because what we hear is our own vibration. And the vibration of the guru is very subtle, and it is always wide open for us, but it won't come into it won't change itself into us. We have to change ourselves into him. Now, that doesn't mean you have to be fully God-realized before you feel or hear or see the guru in your life, but it means you have to be sufficiently in tune with his vibration that quite simply your consciousness can melt into it. And then the degree to which we are in tune with it and the relative refinement of our vibration. And, that can be in a moment of ecstatic meditation. It can be walking in nature. It can be while singing a song. It can be while washing the dishes. It can be while holding your baby child. It can come in any kind of circumstances. Some circumstances more likely bring you in tune with it. But the main reason it comes to us, and this goes back to the letter here finally, is when we offer everything to him. In other words, when we try to be in tune, when it matters to us, he is pleased when we offer him everything. Surrender every little worry to him. So we're walking around the world thinking that I'm in charge and I have to worry about this. Oh, no. I have an infinite guru. I am the disciple of a great master. I am Divine Mother's child. I don't have to worry about this. Here, you take it. And the more complete that surrender can be, the more powerful our vibration changes, and the more we feel the answering vibration of the master. But even a little bit of that surrender shifts us a little bit out of our definition of ourselves as nothing but material, and shifts us at least a little bit toward master. And it starts building, it starts pushing on the upper edge of this. And even if at the beginning it's more of an affirmation that we're doing it, the continuous affirmation that we're doing it, even just simple remembrance, why am I worried about this? Let me instead just call on master to help me. Why am I just trying to figure this out myself? I should be asking master what he wants me to do. These are the specific things Swamiji mentions. And then when we're doing things, feel him working through you, meditating through you, speaking to others through you. See everything that you do as service to him. Ask him to guide you. Swami just puts out these series of declarative sentences, you know, all these different things that we can do. And, you know, and to discipline us, even if we need that. And the more we lean in that direction, the more attuned we become to him. The more attuned we become, the more we feel him within us. That's why Swami said, yes, deepen your attunement with Master. It will help you to develop deeper faith in him because it will give you experience. That's where deeper faith comes. It comes from experience, just like that. I mean, we can read about it, we can affirm it, but what really gives us faith is when it happens. You know, over the course of many years, I have become comfortable with the fact that, not infallibly, I have to say that, and certainly not depending on how intense the challenge might be. But in many, many little things, whereas I used to feel anxious if I didn't know in advance, now I just feel very confident that Master will, in the time that I need it, no, I don't know what to do, but when I need to do it, I will know. And it just happens. It just keeps happening. I mean, I'm talking now with 50 years of experience, but when I begin to get nervous that this time it won't work, which to be fair to myself, I rarely do on a certain level of life, it'll work itself out. You know, I used to be so anxious about all those things, but now experience gives you faith. Master comes through. It's as simple as that. There's something, and this is slightly whimsical, but it's very sweet. There's a lovely woman teacher named Vanmali Devi. She's written several books about Krishna and Rama and perhaps even about Shiva. I can't say for sure. She has an ashram in Rishikesh. She's just a beautiful soul. And I remember when we were talking, she was giving a satsang. We would visit her on our pilgrimages. She's visited in this house with me also on her way to other places. And she's a devotee of Krishna. Let me think how she says this. And she talks about how the context would be having too much to do, feeling overwhelmed that God is giving you too many things to take care of, and you don't feel that you have time. And she told me this story first. She just said, whenever she's in that position where there's a great deal that has to be done, she doesn't know how she's going to do it, she begins to worry. She says she turns all the clocks to the wall and goes on Krishna time. And there's a story in the Bhagavad Gita about how Arjuna had made a certain vow that he would actually kill one of his enemies before the sun went down or else he would sacrifice himself. And it was a pretty serious situation. And the Kauravas, the enemies of Arjuna, managed to keep him from being able to keep his vow because the enemies of Arjuna thought this is how they're going to get rid of him. So it just looked like the sun was going down and it just looked like it was over. I believe that perhaps the clouds obscured the sun briefly. But the sun was sinking. It was over. They knew it was over. So they relaxed their guard. And then the clouds moved aside and Krishna had held the sun in the sky. And so the enemies relaxed their vigilance and Arjuna was able to keep his word. Now, it was quite controversial whether that was cheating or not. But Krishna had done it, so Arjuna was content. But that created something called Krishna time, that normally the sun will sink below the horizon, but not always, because Krishna will intervene. And I loved the concept of Krishna time, because time is elastic, we know that anyway. And I have to tell you seriously, on numerous occasions, when I've been in exactly a situation where I just knew there was too much to do, and I just couldn't get it done, I would just go into Krishna time. It's being asked of me, it needs to be done, therefore it will be done. And without fail, I've been able to do what I needed to do, sometimes in odd ways, because I would think, for example, that this project required this big piece of work, but when I actually got to it, I realized that that really wasn't what was needed, that this was needed. But sometimes it was exactly like was said there. I'll give you one example. My hobby is theater, children, fabric, sewing. I call it my hobby because it justifies my putting about 6 weeks a year into helping our K-8 school with its big theater production, and I make costumes for it. It happens in the spring term, starting in January, February, March is when we do that. And that's also a very good time to travel in India. So sometimes it's a little bit of a confusing situation. Well, one of the times I started working on the play early because I needed to go to India for a few weeks to see Swamiji during that time. And the day before I was going to leave, I had all these people set up who were going to help me do it. There's 80 children in the play, and there's usually at least 150 costumes because many of the children have more than one. And I don't have to sew them all, but I always have to sew some, or somebody has to sew some. So I had all this whole thing set up, but I know for a fact there's a psychological block for a seamstress to cut out the fabric, or most seamstresses. But if you have the fabric cut out, sitting down to sew it is easier. And I just realized that none of those ladies, because I knew from experience, were going to actually sew if I just gave them the patterns. I realized I really needed to cut out all of the patterns and present them to them in a way that they could actually do it. Otherwise, I was going to come home and be really behind on the schedule. And so I was leaving. I had to leave for the airport the next morning at, I don't know what, maybe 9 or 10 o'clock, something like that. But it was about 6 o'clock at night when I suddenly realized what I really needed to do. And I really did exactly what Banmali Devi did. I turned all the clocks to the wall. I just didn't want to know what time it was. I put on Swami reading Revelations of Christ. I don't think I got through the whole book that night, but I listened for a long time, and I just cut out fabric all night long. And, you know, you can kind of tell that it's still night. I knew it wasn't morning, and I just kept working and I actually felt completely at ease. I didn't calculate anything. I just did it like that, and I literally finished like a half an hour before I had to leave. I was already packed. Half an hour before, everything was packed up. I mean, everything was done. Absolutely everything was done in exactly the time allotted. Because it was Krishna time. It had to be done. I'd made a vow. He was going to hold he was going to hold the sun from the sky rather than in the sky. That was a dramatic moment. But honestly, I've had many of those. It's because if we attune ourselves to God, God attunes himself to us. If we really give him our worries, and decide, if you've asked me to do this, if you're disciplining me like this, if you've given this to me, inherent within it is my capacity to face it. Because they're two sides of the same coin. Everything comes from God and is a gift from God. Therefore, everything we are capable of it. If we say, what am I supposed to do, Lord? If we fall out of tune and fall down to that, I'm all by myself in this world and it's all up to me, yeah, then it's a nightmare. So it's always, how can I serve you? What can I do? What do you want of me? Work through me. Speak through me. Share through me. And then after a while, in proportion to our experience, we have faith. I mean, Swami has so much faith. Swami could just sit down and write a book without even knowing what the next chapter is. Swami actually says when he talks, he can actually say, now here's an important point. Then he says later, I didn't really know what the point was, but I could feel an important point was coming. I mean, he's just completely confident because he's so surrendered for so long and has had so much experience of Master's absolute unfailing ability to work through him that he never thinks about it. That which I need in the moment shall be given. I'm an ant on the bottom of the mountaintop. But that little ant has had enough experience to know that he's telling us the truth. Now, the next section of this book is called Advice and Encouragement. Okay. So now, March 5th, 2003. Don't let yourself feel guilty about anything. If people knew all the things they'd done wrong over countless lifetimes and allowed themselves to feel guilty about them all, they'd be unable to bear the burden of existence itself. But bear it they must anyway. As Sri Yukteswar said, forget the past. The vanished lives of all men are dark with many shames, but everything in future will improve if you are making the right spiritual effort now. We can't ever really fail. We can't ever really fail anyone but ourselves, and we can't fail ourselves either if we keep on steadfastly moving in the right direction, upward toward God. That's a very interesting and complicated thing. Guilt is a very, it's a big deal. Let me just think about this for a minute. You know, guilt is not merely acknowledging that, wow, that didn't go as well as I'd hoped. Or I don't know why I said that, but I lost my center and it just seemed like a good thing to say and that wasn't a good thing to have done. Or I feel so guilty because, you know, I betrayed someone. I was like, I promised that I would do this and I wasn't able to, or I took a vow and I didn't keep it. I gave in to temptation and people were hurt. I mean, it's just a huge list. And to acknowledge that I aspired to a higher standard than I was able to meet, that's where Swami says you can't really betray anyone but yourself anyway, and you can't betray yourself if you keep on trying. But if we aspire to a higher level and we can't meet it, that is a fact. To feel guilty about it is to imagine, let me just try to think, it's a hard, I want to get this right. To feel guilty is to imagine that there's something unusual about the fact that we failed, that there has to be this huge sort of reparation made because I failed. I remember a circumstance with Swami and another woman who was a good friend of mine. She did something thoughtless, and as a consequence, there was, I no longer remember the details, but she did something thoughtless, which had a cascading series of which caused a cascading series of events, which ended up putting Swamiji in a fairly difficult position and just causing, you know, nothing catastrophic, but inconvenience and some difficulty and some dissonance with other people, all because of her action. So it happened. It sorted itself out. Like a week later, maybe even 10 days later, my friend, who was a little inclined toward moods at that time, was just sort of moping around. And she and I worked closely with Swamiji, and we were at Swami's house, and he finally said to her, probably couldn't have been that long, it must have only been a few days, he said, "What's wrong with you?" "Oh," she said, "I just feel so badly about what I did." I don't know if she used the word guilty or not, but I feel so badly about what I did. You know, it caused you all that trouble. I just don't know why I did that. Swami looks at her and said, "How egoic." Now, egoic is not quite the same as egotistical. It's ego-based. How egoic. And she was, you know, had enough presence of mind to feel insulted. Egoic? I'm not feeling egoic. I'm feeling terrible. And he said, "Well, I didn't mean you were feeling egotistical, but you're just so much thinking about yourself." And then this is what he said. He said, "You're so shocked that you could make a mistake that all these days later you're still worshiping it." Which was like, wow, that is a super interesting way to say it. He said, "Of course you make a mistake. Everybody makes mistakes." And that was exactly the right thing. It was like she'd made a mistake. Like, did she think she was beyond making mistakes? You know, and was it such a sort of incredible event that she'd made a mistake that now we have to just elevate it and just keep it in the center of our altar of concentration for who knows how long? He said, "Just, you made a mistake. Acknowledge it. Accept it. Don't try to justify yourself. Don't try to whitewash it. But then just see it as just in the normal course of events, given my lack of God realization, which is a fact, mistakes will happen." So you see what the difference is? One is where we hold it to ourselves and constantly worry, and it's very egoic. Because we've just made ourselves so, it's the opposite of humble. And now humility then is another way to express it. Humility, Master defined as self-honesty. That's how Swami put it to us. Self-honesty, it's an absolutely marvelous definition of humility. Because it's self-honesty just says what it is. And if we know, for example, that we're deeply dedicated to God, we are. It's not humble to say, no, I'm not. I really only care about God a little. You know, I'm not really dedicated to the spiritual path. If you are, you are. If you've dedicated yourself to becoming very skillful at something. There's a story told about a famous violinist who, after the concert, who played a magnificent concert, and after the concert, one of his fans said, oh, I'd give my life to be able to play like that. And the violinist said, I have. He's given his life, and that's why he could play like that. There was nothing vain about that. It was just a fact. And it wouldn't have been self-honest to say, oh, no, actually, I didn't really play very well. You know, I missed a note here or something like that. There was a friend of mine who played the flute. She played beautifully. Every time I told her she played beautifully, she told me that, no, she didn't. Because she was so critical of herself, and she was trying to be modest. And after that went on for a period of time, I finally said, you know, this is kind of insulting. I compliment you. And what you essentially say to me is that I'm too much of a Philistine to actually know good music. Because I thought you played well, but in fact you played terribly, so I must be kind of a moron not to be able to tell what good music is. Why don't you just say, I'm glad you enjoyed it? You don't even have to say, yes, I played well. Just be gracious enough to say, I'm glad you enjoyed it. And I said, and the fact of the matter is, you play well, and you know that you do. And she did play well. I mean, she might not have been the best flautist in the world, but that wasn't the issue. Self-honesty was, she was a decent musician, more than that. She played beautifully. And if she didn't, she should keep practicing if she was going to perform. But even if you are the best in the world, even if there's never been anyone better than you in 100 years, you'll be very surprising if anybody even knows your name. You know, things that are just hugely important at one point, just time passes, tastes change, wars destroy the evidence, the yuga shift, nobody knows. And what's a planet anyway in all of creation? And what's a violin in all of creation? Your consciousness matters. Who you've become through that matters a great deal. But self-honesty is just to call it what it is. And guilt is not honest. You've made a mistake. It's not the beginning, the end, or the middle, even the middle of the world. It's just something that happened in the very natural course of events. And if we're self-honest, we're not shocked. We might not be pleased, but that doesn't mean we're shocked. It's just, oh, wow, here we are, we did it again. And we don't have to just gaily dance through it. Swami said it's very important to introspect sufficiently and drop self-justification and see the implications of what you've done. There's the word again, self-honesty. This was not really my brightest move. It seemed like a good idea at the time, but it really wasn't. And you have to see it, accept it, learn what you can from it, make a resolution to go forward. But if you take it with you, all you're doing is just becoming utterly preoccupied with yourself. As Swami said, and I've repeated many times, if all you do is throw dirt on your own head, all you're thinking about is dirt in your own head. Whereas, and is that what we want to be in tune with? You know, if we're just constantly thinking about our guilt, that's what we're in tune with. Then you throw in this whole idea, why do we not remember our past lives? Because the burden of it would be unbearable. Just literally unbearable. It's the mercy of God that they just wipe the slate clean and we get to be an innocent little baby again. And everybody thinks babies are innocent. Swamiji tells the story of Master when somebody handed him their newborn baby. I mean, you know, every parent, oh, here's the great sadhu, I'm going to hand him my beautiful baby. And Master said he almost dropped the child because when he looked at it, he saw, as he put it, the carried over consciousness of a murderer. I mean, everybody dies, and if you're reborn again, you start as a baby. But this baby had the carried over consciousness of a murderer. Now, that soul must have deeply repented because he also had the good karma to be placed into the presence of a God-realized master and to have that God-realized master recognize the karma. And Master's not going to say, oh, you have cooties, get away from me. I mean, Master's not going to be dismayed by being in the present, not going to be personally dismayed for himself to be in the presence of such a consciousness. He says he was startled by it, But what would he try to do? He would try to do what he'd always try to do. He tried to help. He tried to uplift. He tried to burn out some of that karma. You know, just because, I'm holding it like this, just because the body is very small, the capacity to run that body, to communicate, to understand what's going on in the world, to interface with the world in a comprehensive, understandable way, is none of that is there when you're a baby. You're just, you know, a helpless little blob that has to be taken care of in absolutely every respect. But it's important to realize there's nothing small about your consciousness or your intelligence. Everything is intact. The only thing that's not intact is your ability to interact with the world. We just don't know how to do it. And we also kind of get a little, human beings get a little hiatus. We just get a little free ride for a while. I mean, some, depending on how, what your karma is, some people's childhoods are idyllic and some are horrific and some are somewhere in between. But we don't have to take full responsibility for ourselves and our lives. Usually it's about the age of 12 that it begins to come in. And that's why puberty tends to happen at the same time. It's also an astrological, in which the way one of our Education for Life teachers puts it was, prior to about that age, the child does not identify with his own behavior. And this was advice to parents. Children were consistently misbehave, but it's more from their point of view, especially when they're small, misbehavior happens. And of course, they can be trained not to have that misbehavior happen, you know, when they're around. But their sense of myself is different from what they do. And if you really want to help your children grow up in a positive way, the parent also needs to keep clear that the child himself doesn't see himself as his behavior. So something bad may have happened. The child may even have done something bad. The child is not bad. When the parent calls the child bad because bad behavior happens, it's not only hurtful to the child, it's quite confusing. Because his own sense of identity is more fluid at that point and not defined by these specific events. But around the age of 12, the child becomes his behavior. And then when you speak ill of his behavior, you're speaking ill of him. And the way the teacher put it, he said, everything is going fine. And then one bright day when that shift has taken place, you say to your child, your room is really messy. And your former adorable child turns to you and says, you hate me. You've always hated me. And the poor parent is like, oh, we're into the teenage years. Because suddenly the ego has come into the story. And now the ego identifies with what happens around it. And then everything gets a lot harder. So we forget our past lives. We often get this sort of hiatus from personal identification, even with our past actions, during our childhood. That's the carefree time of childhood, before the ego really sets in. But the full consciousness and intelligence are there. So you can see it's a subtle and complicated question. But we get this hiatus, because if we could remember not only all the mistakes that we can remember in this incarnation, but all the ones that we did before. And it would be, you know, you'd be 20 and you'd remember some tragic thing you did at 40 and 50 and 60 and 70. You know, just all, and that's it, just one incarnation. Even when you're 20, you have this, you know, this sort of open-ended expectation. It's a little different when you're 40. You're looking back at things a little bit. There's an expression that up until the age of 40, you have the face that God gave you, and after 40, you have the face that you made for yourself by the kind of consciousness that you ran through it. I had an entertaining period of time once in front of a mirror. Don't ask me how this started, but I realized how these same features could look so different. You know, and you can see people who have anger, who have a habit of anger or a habit of sadness or a habit of tamasic energy, compared to people who are dynamic and wide awake. Swami Kriyananda was so interesting because he became an old man. I'd mentioned Haridas earlier in this. Haridas was 18 when he came. Some of us were not that much older than him. But for a long time, Haridas was the youngest, most notably the youngest. Then there was a day when Haridas's hair began to turn gray. the implications of that were pretty intense for all the rest of us. Because when the baby's hair turns gray, what does that mean about the rest of us? And I've often sat in a room and noticed, like, look, all my young friends are, they all have white hair. I don't happen to have white hair. This is the color God has given me. But I'm not young either. I'm 73 years old now. Now, what was the point of that? What was I saying? I was talking about how even in our younger age, we just, life looks really different to us. But if when we were 20, we could remember being 60 and 70, on one hand, it would be helpful. And on the other hand, it would be very tiresome and confusing. I personally would like to be pretty close to the age I am when I'm born the next time. I would like to have the wisdom of experience before I have experience. Although, to be fair, even to myself, I had a lot of wisdom of experience before I had experience. I came on the path when I was 19, 18. So I was pretty eager. I was pretty ready. But the point being is about guilt. And the guilt is the past lives of all, the vanished past lives. I've always said it's interesting how one will take quotes from the autobiography of a yogi and just lose a word and shift it. I've said this quote many times, the past lives of all men, but that's not what Sri Yukteswar said. He said the vanished lives of all men, which is a much more subtle and interesting word, isn't it? Because they're not merely behind us, they've disappeared, they've ceased to exist. They're just gone. And it's even like the word vanished has a particular feeling. They were there, but now they vanished. They were incredibly real while they were happening, and look, now they're gone. The vanished lives of all men are dark with many shames. I mean, that's kind of an aphorism that I have used and lots of us use when, you know, when we do something that we're not proud of and we wish we hadn't done. You say to yourself, the vanished lives of all men are dark with many shames. So why would I be so surprised? You know, another thing that I find very, very helpful in terms of guilt, extremely helpful. You know, one of the fabulously liberating ideas of learning Sanatan Dharma and understanding avatars, fully self-realized masters, from the point of view of the Bhagavad Gita. See, in the West, where there's just the emphasis is on Jesus, in the Jewish tradition, the Messiah hasn't yet come, and they don't have a tradition of saints. But Judaism morphed into Christianity 2,000 years ago, or Judaism, became, Jesus came to the, was Jewish, but eventually his followers created a new tradition called Christianity, and so they have an avatar. They have one who descended perfectly from heaven, who is one with the Father, and that's Jesus. But there's no context, because it came out of Judaism, and Judaism didn't have a context, and it was placed in an either-or Western world in descending Kali Yuga, so it was just Jesus. So Jesus is this complete anomaly. He just is the only Son of God. Wow, look at that. But you just don't have any idea how he got to be that. And the other thing about it is he'll save you. And all of this is true teaching. You know, he is our Savior. He will take our sins. All of this is Sanatan Dharma in a certain form, meaning it's a true teaching. But it's not clear kind of how it all works. And we really don't know who Jesus is exactly. It's very hard to put him into any context until you get to the Bhagavad Gita, the teachings of Krishna. Whenever virtue declines and vice predominates, I, the infinite spirit, take visible human form to destroy darkness and to reassert Dharma and the light. And I come again and again and again. And that's the Indian tradition, is that periodically, these self-realized masters, who are all Christ, just like Jesus was, appear because mankind calls for him. There's sufficient sincere magnetism to draw the master there, and he delivers a message. It's always the same message in essence, but it's tempered by the yuga, by the culture, by the needs of the disciple. So the masters all agree with each other, but the disciples argue. So what I'm saying is, with Sanatana Dharma, we understand that it is progress from delusion to God realization. That's what the whole science of yoga is. And the master has realized himself as the son of God. And he was, and because all of us are sons of God, and in the Bible it says, St. John says about Jesus, to all who received him, to them gave he the power to become the sons of God. That which I do, ye shall do. And so Jesus never said he was unique. He said his state of consciousness is singular because it's the single reality. But everyone is going to come to that state of consciousness. Now here's the part that's really fun. There was a point when Master wasn't realized. There was a point when Jesus wasn't realized, when that individual, unique jiva, individual soul, was on his way to becoming a master. When a disciple lamented that the instructions that Master were giving him were too hard for him to carry out, the disciple whined, "Well, of course you can do it, sir, because you're a master." And Yogananda, as Swami tells the story, thundered his response, "And what do you think made me a master? It was by doing." And so he's saying he became a master. In other words, he started where we started. Yogananda says he remembers being a gemstone, being a diamond, progressing through all the stages, which is to say, there's no stage on the spectrum between God realization and complete delusion that Jesus Christ himself has not walked. Now, I can't say that he's lived exactly what we've lived because each of us is unique, but every action represents a vibration of consciousness which has inherent realities to it. So there's no place you can stand. There's no vibratory delusion that any of us can pass through that Jesus hasn't passed through, that Paramhansa Yogananda hasn't passed through. They've all just walked exactly the same route. And they got through it. They made it to the other side. They're not shocked. I mean, of course, this is just what's going to happen. When you're vibrating on that level, that's what you're going to do. It's like a six-year-old being really, really guilty. "Oh, mommy, mommy, I'm so sorry I'm not 12. Oh, I want to be 12. I wish I could be 12 for you. I feel so guilty that I'm not 12. That's pretty much exactly, I mean, how much sense does that make? If your six-year-old child feels so terrible because he's not 12, you're going to say, "Honey, you're nuts. You're six. It's fine. Don't worry about it. Of course you can't do it because you're not 12. That's about what we're doing. When we're sitting there eaten up with guilt, and in this weird way, we think we're doing something. Because we're putting out so much energy, and we feel so terrible. Just like my friend said, when Swami said, "How egoic." "I'm not egoic. I'm suffering." Yes, you are. You're totally preoccupied with yourself. You're not really thinking about yourself in an impersonal, objective way. The vanished lives of all men are dark with many shames. Join the club. You know, there's just nothing special about you that requires you to spend all that time worrying about it. Yeah, embarrassment is a different issue. Global humiliation is how I often think about it. Humiliation is often a very interesting thought. Sometimes we feel humiliated. We call that guilt. There was an introspection exercise I just learned, which is, you know, it's not Kriya Yoga, but it's an interesting exercise. When you have a certain feeling, you ask yourself three questions. What am I feeling? What is this feeling? Excuse me. What is this feeling? What does it want? In other words, why is it here? And can I let it go? And I've actually found that very interesting, because there's been certain circumstances in my life, we all have them, where I'm not at peace. And so whenever that comes into my mind, a certain feeling comes into my mind, and when I've asked that question deeper and deeper, what is this feeling? I've realized that a lot of things that try to have put other names on it are just that one is embarrassed, humiliated even. I'll even go to humiliation. Or you just discover that, you know, what I actually am is scared. I'm not even angry. I'm actually scared. What does this want from me? Why does being scared keep coming to me? Why does being guilty keep coming to me? What is What is it that I'm really feeling? And why does it come to me? It's well worth the effort. And then the second half of Sri Yukteswar's marvelous statement is, everything in future will improve if you're making the right spiritual effort now. So that's who we are. We are our aspirations because we're just energy. So by the time we can even see it, it's over. It's vanished. We're sitting here feeling guilty about something that literally does not exist anymore because it was done. You know, you punched him in the face and that was that. Or you yelled at him or you ran away or you failed to help, whatever it might have been. Oh, you let somebody override your better judgment. It's done. And all it is was just a movement in time. Where is it? You know, you can't go pick it up. Oh, look, here it is. You know, no, it's not. It's just a vibration in the ether that we're gripping like this. But what's there? It's just in our minds. That's why it vanishes. Now, it may leave a residual vritti in the chakra, but that's the vritti that we ourselves have created because we've held on to the pattern. But the it no longer exists. That's why that slight shift from past, from vanished to past, really diminishes the meaning. The vanished lives. This is vanished, except that I keep pretending that it hasn't. And I am what I aspire to become, and as long as I keep aspiring, and that's why he said, we can't ever really fail anyone but ourselves, which is to say everybody has their own karma, and even if you, and this is a very good way to think about it, even if you participate in someone else's karma, you don't create it, because you wouldn't have been there if it wasn't their karma to have that experience. Even though Master says we make a grave mistake, sometimes he says things that are so marvelous and incomprehensible until you really look at them. Because one thing follows another, because of the illusion of time, it appears to us we experience that one thing follows another, and therefore we have the mistaken idea that one thing causes another, because they happen sequentially. So somebody does something and I feel hurt. Somebody makes a mistake in the car and we have an accident, you know, but I wouldn't be in the car if it wasn't my karma. I wouldn't have been the recipient of your anger if it wasn't my karma. You might have had the karma to be angry, but it wouldn't have been at me unless it was my karma to have it. You may have had the karma to behave in an inappropriate manner, but it wouldn't have involved my life unless it was my karma to have that happen, you see? We participate in each other's karma, but we don't cause it. So this is why it says you can't even really betray anyone but yourself. Because they needed to be betrayed. They weren't really betrayed by you. They were betrayed by their own destiny, and you participated in it. Now, you have betrayed yourself in the sense that you have failed to live up to the highest ideals that you know, because the past lives of all men are dark with many shames. But we are our aspirations. So then Swami goes on to say, but we can't fail ourselves either if we keep on steadfastly moving in the right direction, upward toward God. That's where Master said in another context, God doesn't mind our failures, he only minds our indifference. And it's not even that God is displeased with our indifference, but what he's trying to say is, it doesn't matter how many times we fail. Absolutely, and the only thing that matters is that it matters to us that we failed. And don't think of that as grief. That's what Master means by our indifference. Our indifference to our upward aspiration. Because if we become indifferent to upward aspiration, then we really, well, at least for the time, then we just wait. And we just get to suffer more. That's all that happens. Some pop culture person put it really marvelously. He said, if you fight for your delusions, guess what? You get to keep them. You know, like what kind of a prize is that? When we insist on being terrible, being guilty, being wrong, holding to this point of view, being indifferent to God, demanding to understand the difference between Sabbakalpa and Nirvikalpa Samadhi. We have to understand it before we're going to decide whether or not to begin to meditate. You know, it's just like we get to keep our delusions. That's the prize, big prize. Like, who wants it? It's not easy, but it's really very simple. And, you know, here in this, just this little letter about guilt, if we can let go of guilt, it creates an astonishing freedom in our lives. Guilt is really absolutely, completely without any value. Guilt is quite different than honest introspection, accepting responsibility, resolving to do better, and putting out energy to do that. That's entirely different than guilt, because for all the reasons that I've said, and God certainly recommends that. And we just persevere. We can't lose. We're absolutely guaranteed to succeed. Well, my friends, I think that will carry us through this evening. God bless you.